open the House Committee on Agriculture and Natural Resources. It's May 23rd. Welcome back, everybody. Since we're meeting infrequently, I feel like we've lost touch and we should spend some time just talking and getting to know each other again. Okay, just kidding. Let me open a work session on Senate Bill 18A. Remind us what this is, Misty, while Vice Chair Springer and I get all scripts prepared.
Okay, Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Senate Bill 18A would designate the Oregon Department of Agriculture as the state agency having primary responsibility to administer and enforce duties, functions, and powers imposed on or granted to state agencies under the Food Safety Modernization Act.
Okay, how about a motion?
Chair Clem, I move Senate Bill 18A to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Vice Chair Springer moves Senate Bill 18A to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Is there any discussion?
First one.
Any objections? Okay. Motion passes. Can this go on the consent calendar to try and get our bills done more quickly? Does anybody have any issues with that? Okay. We'll put that on the consent calendar. Let me open a work session on Senate Bill 372A. This is a roadkill bill.
Mm-hmm.
Yep, this is a roadkill bill for roadkill Bill Hansel. And
Chair Clem, I move that Senate Bill 372A to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Vice Chair Springer moves Senate Bill 372A to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Any discussion?
Yes.
Vice Chair Springer.
Thank you. So, done a fair amount of research on this. I'm going to support this measure. I do have some concerns with folks poaching their deer, getting their deer, and then going and calling in, and because you'll be able to do this online, getting their roadkill tag, if you will, salvage tag. So, we will be the first state to do it this way, that allows you to dispatch the animal. We will be the first state. So I urge the department, and I know that they're going to do this without me urging them, to track this and see if we have numbers that are out of line with other states. I'm sure you're going to see trends, if there is a trend develop as far as an inordinate amount of roadkill, and then they're dispatched, and the tag under which the circumstances could be telling. Evening and so forth. So I want to track this carefully to see if we need to come back and change it or undo it, because we are the first to do it this way.
Representative Brock Smith.
Thank you. And I appreciate Representative Springer's concerns. I worked with ODFNW and had some conversations on this, and as far as streamlining the process, I think we're good. I think we're good, but I appreciate the keeping tabs on the possibilities of maybe having to do some tweaks in the future. But I'm fine with this going on the consent calendar as well.
Representative Escobar.
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chair. I share concerns as well as with Representative Springer. But on the other hand, if we don't have people that are adept enough to see whether a thing's been bloodshot from being hit by a car or shot, then we have a real problem in our Department of Fish and Wildlife, because who's going to hit a deer and then shoot it, or who's going to shoot it and then run over it? If you run over it after it's dead, you're not going to bloodshot it. So I have some, you know, I'm not too concerned about that. I think it'd be easy to find once you took the hide off.
Okay, I'm not sure what a bloodshot is, but Representative Witt.
I was just going to say that some of us tenderize our meat before
with a pickup. Okay.
So there is a motion.
There is a motion. I had both amendments drafted because I didn't really know where the committee wanted to go, but I guess I probably feel similarly. We could try it, and if we think it's starting to cause problems, or too many gray areas, then come back and address it. I'd like to think that, yes, people aren't going to shoot it, figure out how to prop it up to really hit it good to make sure you got it's pretty heavy dead weight.
Look at the damage you do to your
car. So then you got to have a cattle guard on the front of it. I mean, it's a lot of work to go through to simulate an accident. But you never know. There's some people out there who might. So, Vice Chair Snyder.
I got to weigh in on that one. I'm still trying to figure out what bloodshot is. I don't know. But
I'm glad it's not just me.
I think we're under the impression, and I might be wrong in this, but I think it sounds like some of us are under the impression that state troopers are going to investigate every death. I've not been under the impression that that would occur. So I don't think we need to worry about propping them up. I think it will be online. Correct. I keep looking in the back, then get a tag. So I do, and they're not all going to be investigated. So I want to be very clear, because I was almost a no on this. I want to be very clear that we're going to track that data and trend lines.
Thank you. My thought was, if you're a poacher, your big risk is getting caught driving from where you killed the animal to home, then you better prop it up and hit it if you really want to be sure. But I just don't know that they'll go to that much work. You know, so that's a silly thing to be debating. But you never know. So I would just say we should probably keep our eyes on it too. And if we see a whole large number. I also thought about it the other way. How many people are packing a gun around when they hit a deer? A certain chunk.
A certain chunk.
I grew up in your district. I know, but I didn't pack guns all the time. Like, it was just occasionally. And so. Okay, then. We got a motion on the floor. Any more discussion?
We just want to know, Mr. Chair, if your deer had pupils that were dilated.
It's about pupils.
Yeah, that's the problem is I never killed a deer there. I always had to go to Eastern Oregon to get one. I was that bad of a hunter. I need big, wide open space.
No brush.
Yeah. Okay. Any further discussion on roadkill bill?
Hope not.
All right then.
Where is he?
Roadkill bill.
Would the clerk please call the roll?
Representative Beretta?
Aye.
Representative Esquivel?
Aye.
Representative McEwen?
Aye.
Representative Power?
Aye.
Representative Brock Smith?
Aye.
Representative Witt?
Aye.
Vice Chair McClain?
Excused.
Vice Chair Springer?
Aye.
Chair Clement.
Aye. A motion passes. This is probably not one we should put on the consent calendar.
If
you've got to talk about it.
Just trying to help Senator out.
Yes.
If you'd like.
Oh, I got a carry off.
Yeah, well, I'm on the bills.
Oh, okay. Well, why don't we have...
Give it to him. I'm not on the bills.
No, that's carry on. Carry on.
And given you might half-heartedly carry it with...
Fine form today. We are just in fine form today.
Okay, so let's open a work session on Senate Bill 373A. This is the invasion of the deers into small towns in rural Oregon, where they pin people into their houses, according to the photos sometimes, and scare them, and this gives ODF&W a chance to do something about it.
Chair Clem, I move Senate Bill 373A to the floor with a due pass.
And I read that right off the SMS. That's exactly what the SMS said. Yeah, if I didn't call it invasion of the body... Okay. Any discussion on 373A?
He's on his game today.
That's right. Okay. Any objection to 373A? Okay. I think, what about a content counter? Do we want to talk about the invasion of the deer in various small towns?
That's a no-brainer.
I don't care.
Consent calendar, no objection. Okay, consent calendar. Get out of here for Memorial Day. Okay, now, we're going to hear about aquifer recharge projects around Oregon. I know some of you may have other things you have to get to, but I'm pretty excited about this myself, and we have a panel who came a long way. So let me open our informational meeting on aquifer recharge projects around Oregon. And I think my first panel is Doug Woodcock, Jen Woody, and Justin Iverson. Okay, please join us. Ooh. Slide. Those lights dimmed a little bit.
Why is ball is not working.
Please, whoever would like to start us off, I'm just getting comfortable here. Thank you.
Mr. Chair, committee members, thank you for the invitation today to talk about aquifer projects in Oregon. I'm Doug Woodcock, Deputy Director of Oregon Water Resources Department. And today I am joined by Jan Woody, hydrogeologist and the person that runs the aquifer recharge program in our agency. And on my left is Justin Iverson, the groundwater program manager where the aquifer recharge program resides. And since we have guests from afar, I suggest we just get started here.
Okay. Representatives, Mr. Chair, for the record, my name is Jen Woody. We're here today to talk about aquifer recharge. I'm going to start with just some basic information about aquifers. So moving right in, while the earth appears solid to us, most rocks near the Earth's surface are composed of both solids and voids. Without those voids in the ground, we wouldn't have water supply wells, we wouldn't have springs. It's useful to think of two broad categories of water-bearing rocks. Unconsolidated materials, like the picture you see on the left, like sand, gravel. The water in that type of rock occurs in the pore spaces. The other kind of rock is more consolidated, and water occurs in the fractures in the rock. And so that's what you see on the right. Any saturated rock is referred to as an aquifer. And different kinds of rocks really have different water-bearing capabilities. So the example I always like to use is if you think of a 5-gallon bucket, you filled that 5-gallon bucket up with gravel, and then you tried to pour in water, you could probably pour in a couple gallons of water. If you had that same 5-gallon bucket, you poured a bunch of wet cement in it, let it harden, and then smash that cement with a hammer, you can imagine you could pour a lot less water in there, so maybe a quart. And that's similar to the different water-bearing properties of these different kinds of rocks. Okay, we've got some cartoons here, so imagine we're zooming in on those two buckets. On the left side, we've got the sand and gravel. The gray there is the particles of gravel. The blue is the water. So on the top box there, you'll see there's a little more space between those grains of sand. Those pore spaces are connected, and so that allows water to move through those materials relatively easily. On the bottom left-hand side, you see the same kind of deal. We've got sand and gravel, but there's not a lot of space in between those pores. So we call that less permeable or less flow can occur there. And it's the same principle when we think about fractured rock. Those fractures have to be well connected in order for water to move through it easily. So this is a cartoon of a couple different kinds of aquifer recharge. On the top there, you see those circles. Those represent sort of a sand and gravel type aquifer. So unconfined, there's some pore space there. The blue represents water, so that's a saturated portion of the aquifer. And below that is depicted a deeper aquifer. So that'd be more like a fractured rock aquifer. There's some low permeability zone between the land surface and that aquifer. So managed aquifer recharge is a term that you've probably heard. It refers to a variety of different techniques for recharging groundwater. On the top of that cartoon, you see a basin where you can divert water, apply it to a leaky canal or a leaky basin, allow that water to infiltrate down to the water table and augment your water supply. The other way you can do this is by injecting water through a well. And so that's what you see on the right side, where you inject the water through the well and add it to the aquifer that way. So it's a more pressurized situation. Okay. So there's different characteristics of the geology that are going to determine how suitable certain kinds of rocks are for managed aquifer recharge. One of the things that you always want to think about is how much storage do you need, and is that storage available in that geologic formation? So going back to our cartoon where we zoomed in on sand and gravel, you can see there's more storage if we've got a material where the pore spaces are connected. We've got less storage if it's a compacted type aquifer, less pore space. So if you think back to the sand and gravel type bucket, that would have more storage than the bucket that's full of a fractured rock. Okay, so what you see here are one of the things we have to think about Again, we've got a cross-section into the earth. On the left side is a recharge basin. I apologize, the figure looks a little cut off there. But in addition to thinking about the storage capacity of an aquifer based on pore size or fracture size, there's also the concern that if I store water in this aquifer, is it going to be here when I want to recover it? Most of these projects are storing water during the season when there's a lot of water and need to recover it during the high demand season. So if you're going to invest in that sort of project, you really want to know that that water is going to be there when you come back in 6 months and need to recover it. So different geologic settings are going to be more suitable to that. On the left side, that was depicting sort of a sand and gravel aquifer where you have a low permeability rock below it, and so it contains that water, prevents it from flowing quickly away. On the right side is a scenario where there's not any low permeability zone below your storage aquifer, and so that water could potentially get away from you. Might be less suitable for long-term storage. Okay, so this is a complicated map. It's a geology map. Every color there represents a different kind of rock that's exposed on the surface. I know you can't read the labels or anything. The point being here, we have a lot of different kinds of rocks in Oregon. Just to give you a general tour, on the coast there, we have the Coast Range, low permeability, fractured marine sediments, so sandstone, mudstone. In the southwest, we have more fractured rock that tend to be very low yielding. Of course, we've got the Cascades in the central and southeast portion of the state, a lot of volcanics, and those can range from very permeable to very low permeability. The pink color you see there across the northeastern part of the state, that's representing the Columbia River basalts. Those are an unusual kind of rock that is highly used for aquifer as a groundwater source. It's unusual in that wells in that formation can yield high rates. However, it tends to store kind of a small amount of water, so it is prone to decline. And what I bring that up because that becomes an issue for storage projects in Oregon. Okay, so what you see here is that same map, and what we've done is taken a look at every kind of rock, considered its different storage capacity characteristics, and just roughly categorized it from kinds of rocks that have more storage capacity than others. And so you'll see the red color is depicting the least amount of storage. So that would be your Coast Range, sandstone, mudstone, southwest region, metamorphic type rocks. And then your more suitable rocks, the green there depicts the Columbia River basalts, and the yellow there is a lot of the porous sedimentary type aquifers that we have at the surface. So this map shows where we have artificial groundwater recharge sites in Oregon now, so ones that are currently permitted and operating. Each dot represents a project. The smaller the dot, the smaller the volume that it stores each year. You can see we have a wide range in size, so we've got quite small ones that are less than 3 million gallons, up to 6,000 acre feet or 2 billion gallons per year. So we see a few irrigation-type projects in the Umatilla Basin, and there's one in the Willamette Basin, and the rest are primarily municipal. So these are projects that have access to surface water all year round, and instead of building a reservoir, they're able to inject some of that water underground during the winter and then recover it when their high-demand periods happen.
Representative Perrano.
Yeah. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Yeah. So are all these dots or little circles, are they all injected, or is some of them just gravity down? And then if they're injected, is there a complicated filtration process that they go through before they inject it in?
Representative, Mr. Chair, these dots represent a variety of different kinds of recharge. So there are a couple infiltration basin type ones out near Hermiston. There's the largest one. out in Milton Freewater. There's another one, so infiltration-type basins. The rest are primarily injection wells. As far as water quality, there are different water quality requirements for these projects. The ones that inject through wells basically have to meet drinking water standards. Yeah. And so, you know, a municipality is in the business of making drinking water. It kind of makes sense for them. However, there are irrigation projects that are able to meet those standards when their sources are groundwater. So groundwater can meet a drinking water standard.
Thank you.
So now I'm just going to give you a couple different examples where this is being used. This one is out in Morrow County and Umatilla County. This is an irrigation supply project. It's been operating since 1978. They divert surface water from the Umatilla River in the winter and the early spring. And what you see there on the right, that's an aerial photograph of the area. They have a canal that's intentionally kept clean, and it leaks so that they can run the water through there in the winter, let it infiltrate down into the groundwater. So it's a gravel aquifer, and there's a group of 20 to 25 wells that then can recover that water to supplement their irrigation supply. And so another kind of example here in the city of Salem, there's a injection-type storage project that began in 1997. Stores a smaller volume of water than the Umatilla example, but it's injection through wells into a basalt aquifer, and it diverts water from the North Santiam River, primarily in winter, sometimes spring. So to give you an idea of kind of change over time here, the x-axis is years. So starting in 1970-something, you see storage began. It was pretty much around 2,000 million gallons per year for a number of decades. That Umatilla County example was, I think, the only project going for a number of years. Then in the mid-90s, we saw a number of new projects come online, and you see the volume per year starting to increase. The other thing I'd point out about is the big spike there is probably catching your eye. That was a very wet year in 2011. And so that allowed folks to divert more water than they usually could and store it for later use. And then in 2015, you see it's headed down again. Well, that was a very dry year, so folks didn't have access to store water. So that's kind of one of the interesting features about artificial groundwater recharge is you can access water without having to build your reservoir, right? So if you're a city and your reservoir was 3 million gallons size, that's all you could store. You know, you're done once that's full. In this kind of a scenario, you have the potential to have a little more flexible storage plan. And with that, I'll leave it for questions. Thank you.
So how or what do we know about the Umatilla project, since that's the big one we've done lately?
Mr. Chair?
Quantifiable ways to measure how much new activity there can be because we did this, you know, during dry times.
Right. So that particular project, we've been monitoring the water levels there every year. That's really the gauge that we use to see if stored water is still sticking around. Really investigating the potential for this technology is site specific. So you really have to look carefully at the geology of each site, the water quality of your source water, and determine whether this is going to be feasible. That project is a good example of kind of early use of this technology. It's been very consistent. You know, they store pretty much the same amount of water every year, and they have been able to meet their supply in an area of shortage.
Mr. Chair, if I may, what Jen said right there is key. This is a critical groundwater area. So years ago, the groundwater users out there depleted that gravel aquifer, and that created a whole lot of space in that aquifer. And they were very innovative in being able to, working to capture that water out of the Umatilla River and run it down their canal in the wintertime. And they have, I would say, largely restored. There's still room there. But what this has done for them is, because it's a critical groundwater area, they would have been limited in how much water they could take out each year. And now this is a whole additional bucket of water that's theirs. They've stored it. It's theirs to use as they need later in the summer. Okay. So very innovative and helps them out tremendously in their agricultural work.
Representative McCann.
Thank you, Chair Klein. What is the cost of a project like that?
That was a big one. I remember voting for it. But I know it was one of the first we did, so it was kind of experimental.
Mr. Chair, Representative, these are expensive projects. The gravel infiltration, not so much. But you need your water supply. You need your infrastructure to get the water there. You need your infrastructure to take the water out again. That's the infiltration basin. I believe even more expensive than that, you would be looking at the injection, so what we call aquifer storage and recovery, where the water is treated first and then injected down into the well and then monitored. So there's monitoring that goes on to make sure that the chemistry is not altering the aquifer down there. And then in addition to that, you want to monitor to make sure that that water is staying around. Mm-hmm. And then that's their water to use later on. If the monitoring shows that it's drifted away, then that water isn't there for them to use. So that makes it ultra expensive at that point. So they have a volume then that they can take out later. Expensive.
I mean, I'm trying to remember.
Billions, it was, I assume.
Okay. I feel like it was, I don't want to say the number because I feel like it's really high.
It's okay.
I mean, it was, I thought it was in the tens of millions, but maybe it was not quite that much. But I for some reason, I have like the number $40 million sticking in my head, but that might be wrong.
But follow up.
Yeah. So,
but on the Umatilla, and pardon me, I don't know anything about this project. Is it agricultural and municipal, or is it just agricultural?
Well, take it.
Representative, Mr. Chair, there's that particular irrigation one is just agricultural. Okay. There are municipal projects in the Umatilla Basin, the city of Pendleton, for example. Great. Thank you.
Okay, thank God. I'm way off. So we appropriated in, I don't know if this was the only money we ever put in, $2.5 million to implement a pilot project out there in 2009.
Was that the entire cost, or was it partnered? Was there some sort
of a... You're getting me just off of Google, but...
Thank you.
So we should never go by your memory.
No, we clearly shouldn't. Though I think it's a lot more than that. Representative Escobar.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Why would you treat the water if it's going for irrigation and also if the municipality were using it for drinking water, wouldn't they treat it when it came out?
Yeah. You'd have to.
Take one.
So are we double treating it?
Mr. Chair, Representative, to go back and talk about the injection piece first, so that is our aquifer storage and recovery. That program was largely developed by the municipalities because they have a source of water in the wintertime, they have year-round rights, and they have the treatment system and the money to treat the water. So that program was set up such that they were capturing, developing their drinking water to drinking water standards, putting it down in the aquifer to stay there. It comes back out. They do a minor treatment to that, and then they're back in business again. The big treatment is up front when they're first capturing that surface water.
Follow up. Well, but if they're taking the water out of the Columbia or they're taking out of the aquifers, they would still have to treat it the same way. I'm not understanding why we're... Yep. Double treating this.
Mr. Chair and Representative, for the record, again, my name is Justin Iverson, and I'm the groundwater section manager at the Water Resources Department. To address your question, as Doug pointed out, the municipalities have a treatment plant. That treatment plant is built to treat a rate of water during peak demand time. So summer peak demand is what people design their plant for. In the winter time, it's operating at much lower levels because demand is lower. So they have this capacity that they can then treat water at a very low kind of per unit cost because the plant's already running. It costs roughly the same to run it at 1 million gallons a day versus 2 million gallons a day and put one MGD into storage. So it's relatively inexpensive for them to treat water from whatever their primary source is. When they put it into the ground, the chlorine that they chlorinate the water with will degrade. And when they recover that in summer, as Doug said, they do a minor retreatment, which is basically just rechlorination so that it meets Department of Health standards when it goes into their municipal distribution system. So the second treatment is really a rechlorination. It doesn't go back through the treatment plant.
Representative Barreto.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So these aquifers, they're all different sizes. Are they closed? I mean, when you say here's this aquifer below a, whether it's municipality or whether it's irrigation, you know, is it a specific size or do they leach from aquifer to aquifer? And then do you have these measured around the state? You know, you had the geology map that showed the different types of grounds, but do you have these aquifers kind of labeled? And then are they just all different sizes all over the state depending on how deep you go?
Mr. Chair, Representative, as Jen was saying, it's case by case where these aquifer recharge projects occur, and it really does take testing to go in there and understand whether that water is going to be there or not. We were showing you some generalized areas of where recharge is generally believed to work, and areas that we just know you're going to be spending a lot of money for not. Okay. So we have it generally, but when it comes time for somebody to actually propose and implement a project, we always go through a testing phase first, just so we can understand that system.
Follow up. So like over in Umatilla where you have this reinjection, and you said if you didn't do this, the irrigation wells, they wouldn't have that. So you have that aquifer there already sized. Basically, you know how many gallons it holds and how much they pump out, how much it is reduced. And do they use a percentage of that every year then? And then do they inject back in exactly what they use, or are they trying put more in, or how does that work?
Mr. Chair, Representative, I'm going to pass the microphone to the person that actually calculates those.
Representative, Mr. Chair, that Umatilla project, we have fairly solid understanding of the extent of that aquifer. When you ask the question, do we know how many gallons it holds, that's always a difficult question to answer because the geologic materials are variable over space. So what we do know is they divert a variable amount of water each year depending on availability. Some years that are wet, like this year, there's a good access to a lot of water. Other years that are dry, a lot less water. So when you apply, say, 6,000 acre feet per year this year, we know, okay, we applied that water to this land and we see the water levels come up a certain amount. So that gives us a general idea of, you know, this change in depth to water represents this amount of water. But it's generally very hard to quantify. And that's a project where we have 30 years of data and we're still working on it. So
just one last follow-up. So all of those pumps that they pump out of over there, they have meters on them so they know exactly what they're pumping out every year.
Representative, Mr. Chair, that yes, they are required to have flow meters. We go around every February, measure water levels, and read the flow meter so that we can calculate their storage account for the year.
And I just realized that because we started late and we have people came all the way here from Idaho, I should keep us moving along, and we can always revisit Oregon-related water things at another time. Sorry about that.
Very good. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you. Okay, let me get Michael McVeigh, Wesley Hipke from Idaho Water Resources here. Thanks for coming so far to spend time with us.
You are very welcome.
Well, good morning. Thank you. So, you know, as we sat and listened to the Oregon Water Resources Department's talk, they stole a lot of my thunder.
Mm-hmm.
And I think it's actually good news because
just need your name for the record.
Oh, I apologize. My name is Michael McVeigh.
Great. Thank you.
Uh-huh. I'm a water resources engineer at the Idaho Department of Water Resources, and this is Wesley Hipke. He's our recharge program manager for the state of Idaho. And so to continue with my premature preamble there, I think it's very important that you rely on your technical working group there in the Oregon Water Resources Department, because it is important to test to understand what's going on beforehand, but it's also important to have people with the know-how to continue and operate these systems and understand if you're getting what you wanted out of them. I really like the technical information they gave. I think it really helps, and it helps you understand what you're looking and trying to do. So what I want to do is just give you a quick overview of some of our experiences, and then hopefully that will lead to some questions, and then we're actually going to meet with the Oregon Department people here afterwards, and maybe we can have a more of a complete information exchange.
Right.
And so please feel free to ask questions. It actually helps a little bit, and Wesley has vast experience, and so it'd be nice to leverage him as well. So, you know, Wesley is the program manager for the state of Idaho, and in the state of Idaho, the state takes the lead in managed aquifer recharge. So we finance the majority of it, we plan and coordinate the majority of it, and then we operate it through our private partnerships. So although it's a statewide program, it's in its nascent stages. The driver, the primary recharge area, is the Eastern Snake Plain Aquifer, and I'm just going to call it the ESPA because it's a mouthful. And so that ESPA is actually quite similar to the Deschutes Basin, which is what we were asked to come here and talk about or provide information to help you understand. And they're similar in a couple ways. One, they're similar geologically, in that they're both basalt aquifers. They're fractured material, highly transmissive, but probably not very much storage in them. And they both rely on precipitation is snow up in the highlands to provide the water for the basin. So it has to precipitate outside of where you're using it, melt, come into the basin, and then you redistribute it for use later on. It's also important to note that they're very similar with their water use history, in that these aquifer water levels were slowly built up over time, basically due to inefficient surface water irrigation, where they deliver water through leaky canals to then irrigate with a flood irrigation scheme, which provides a lot of incidental recharge. But then over time, groundwater pumping gets developed, surface water irrigation becomes more efficient, you have metropolitan growth, climate change, all these things conspire to result in lower aquifer water levels. And so now you have groundwater problems, but that, you know, much like the ESPA, you're also going to run into stream flow, stream reach gain issues, and maybe even spring discharge as well. And so everything kind of gets wrapped up into this. Well, it was an anthropogenic aquifer is now the economic reality that you're living with. And as those water levels go down, can you still support the economy that you build up around them? And that's where recharge comes into play, because you're trying to redistribute the water in a storage-type scenario. Like the SPA, the Deschutes Basin will leak, and so that gets a little bit more complicated. We began recharging the ESPA because, well, we're facing an economic catastrophe, basically. You know, it's about 30% of our state's economy. We have a moratorium on groundwater applications, so there's no more growth in the cities, no new businesses are coming in, no new farms are being developed. So now we've heavily constricted our most important economic region, and it's actually starting to contract because there's no growth, people don't look to it anymore, and they're looking to leave. Yeah. On top of that, we aren't able to provide the water for all the uses we've assigned to it. We now have litigation unending, to the tune of about $65 million. And so the state looked at this and said, we cannot continue in this manner. We need to step in. Now, from our perspective, the state was a good place to start, because recharge, it's the equal opportunity benefactor, but it's also very diffuse. And so it's hard to assign a specific economic benefit to it sometimes. So, for example, if you want to recharge for mitigation, you may not be able to recapture everything that you put into the ground, but it's going to help you some other place where you have issues. And so for private recharge, from our point of view, it was very difficult to accomplish because the individual entities needed to recoup. But in actuality, we have a lot of problems that recharge addresses. And so the individuals need to come to terms with the fact that what they're doing is going to benefit other users as well, and they may not get 100% of what they put into it. And I think, you know, Oregon Department of Water Resources illustrates that pretty well, and it's basin specific. Again, I think they also told you that monitoring is key. How do you know what's working? You've got to look and you've got to see. So now the wells not only tell you if water is reaching the aquifer, but they also help you understand if you're having water quality impacts as well. And then in Idaho, we also monitor spring flow and reach gains as well to see if that diffuse effect is affecting other reaches, other parts of the aquifer system. So like I said, we work with private entities to conduct the recharge, and we had to work with the environmental community to make sure we did it right. That was some of the major concern, was from the environmental groups. Are we going to pollute the aquifer? Are we going to degrade the resource that we already have? And are we going to conduct recharge in a way that interferes with the health of the river, interferes with fish propagation and habitat? And so working together, we were able to come up with procedures and policies that prevent injury but allow us to move forward, because both sides realized that doing nothing was the worst scenario of all, and that we had to move forward. And if this is successful, it will result in increased spring flows, increased reach gains. And so by working together, we come to a conclusion that we now are involved in a long-term project. You can kind of see it, and you could, I don't know if they addressed it directly, but the weather changes from year to year. And if you don't recharge from year to year, you lose it, because it's a leaking aquifer. And so this is a consistent change that you want to affect. And I think of it less as addressing a problem as just a change in water use. And basically, we're trying to recreate what happened in the past with the inefficient surface water irrigation practices. And so just to move on, since we are short on time, there's a few main points that we have gleaned from what we've been doing. And again, I think you guys know a lot of this, or at least the Department of Water Resources, or Water Resources Department does. And that is, recharge may be the only practicable way to bring more water into your basin. You can do these recharge or storage studies for surface reservoirs. They become extremely expensive, extremely contentious, and they can take decades to complete, whereas the recharge, you may be able to start increasing your storage at a much cheaper price and a much earlier time. The benefits are widespread, and don't let the technicalities of where the water, every molecule of water are going, dissuade you, because there's going to be benefits all over the place. And it's just a matter of determining the economic benefits, the economic drivers for all the parties involved, whether it be public or private entities. Can you make this pencil out? That's a big one right there. I think you guys have already started, at least on the private side, and I would suggest that start sooner rather than later, because a lot of these technical issues that you're going to have to discuss and work out, that you might get wrapped around the axle on, will kind of work themselves out when you start seeing what's happening. Because remember, we're trying to recreate what happened in the past, so this shouldn't be a disaster scenario. You shouldn't be doing something that will result in harm. And then finally, I guess the big point is what is your alternative? You know, in the face of changing climate, changing water use, changing society, you need to find a way to get more water into your basin. This may be one of the only ways to do it. And with that, we'll take questions, and we'd appreciate it.
So my name's Wesley Hipke, and I'm the recharge program manager for the Idaho Water Resources Board Recharge Program. There's just a couple things I want to add to what Mike said, just for clarity, given we're on record. It's not if our recharge program is going to work, it's when it works. Just had to put that in there. And really, the only other thing that I want to add before taking your questions, so far as a little my background, which is pertinent here, I spent 19 years with the Arizona Department of Water Resources working and building their recharge program. And so I've been in Idaho department for the last 2 years. And so that's given me a wide range and breadth of recharge in really different scenarios. So with that, any questions that you have, we'll do our best to answer.
Any questions for these gentlemen?
Chair Klim.
Representative McEwen.
Thank you. Gentlemen, I appreciate your testimony a lot. This is very eye-opening. But I think the question I would ask is, compared to Arizona and Idaho, where is Oregon in moving through this process?
So, with the little research that I've done, and it's not just Oregon, here's what I've seen from my perspective, is recharge has been around as a potential management tool for years. You guys started back in the 1970s. They first looked at it in the ESPA in 1962. So it's been around a long time, and a lot of states, and I have a whole list of states that have done projects here or there. But far as developing recharge programs, the only ones I really know of are Arizona and Idaho. Arizona started, it was the 1980s, but really didn't get kicked off until the late 1990s. Currently, they have the capacity of recharging around over 600,000 acre feet per year. What they're recharging right now is somewhere in the realm of 350 to 500,000 acre feet per year. I really don't know of any other state that's done that volume or has set up that strongly. With Arizona, with Idaho, our goal is to reach 250,000 acre feet per year. And what our legislative body has set up is our goal is to reach that by 2024. We're on track to have a capacity to do that by 2020. Honestly, a lot depends on the weather, so I need to build more capacity than just reaching that to handle the variability. There's some years there's a lot less, some a lot more. Other than that, I haven't really heard, it's after those two states from what I know of. It starts going down pretty quick. And I know with Idaho, there's a lot to develop within the program. As far as a lot of the entities are still figuring out, okay, what do we need to do as far as water quality? How do we track things? There's a lot of things that we're developing.
Yeah, thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So you said the Eastern Snake River area, is that over Pocatello, Idaho Falls?
It is. It's actually a huge aquifer. It covers almost 11,000 square miles. And it goes from the eastern boundary of our state past Twin Falls, about halfway between Twin Falls and Boise. So it covers that area.
It's big.
It's huge.
That's your project that you're working on now. But a lot of growth projected in the Boise area in the next few years. Is the aquifer there sufficient for the growth, or are you starting to look at that too?
We are starting to look at that. I spent most of my life in recharge. I'm a huge fan of recharge, and it is a tool. And so it depends a lot exactly what your department's that it really depends on the question you're answering and is it a fit for that area. The Treasure Valley, which includes Boise, is really interesting. Half of it, the water levels are at like 8 foot, 2 foot, etc. It's way high. The other part of it's not. And actually, one study we're going to be undertaking this next year is really looking at it, going, how much water do we have available? What areas would actually make sense to recharge in and get a handle on what some of that cost would be so we can start setting parameters?
Okay, we've got one more panel, and then I know you're going to meet with our water resources. Some of us may end up wanting to sit in on that, too. So let me get our other panel up.
I just want to say thank you for coming all the way over from Idaho.
Absolutely.
It's really our pleasure.
Great.
Thank you for having us.
Chair Clem.
Just 1 second. While these gentlemen are in transit, we are, just in case I lose people, going to pause this informational meeting. And I would like a motion to suspend the rules for the purposes of letting the other vice chair vote on the bills.
So, Mr. Chair, I move that we suspend the rules and allow Representative McClain to vote on Senate bills. Can I do them all at once?
Yeah.
Senate bills 373A, 372A, and 18A.
Okay. Vice Chair Springer moves that we suspend the rules for the purpose of allowing Vice Chair McClain to vote on several bills. Any objection? Seeing none. Okay, so let's do 18A first. This is the FDA Modernization Act.
Yes.
Okay. And how about a roadkill bill? This is Senate Bill 372A.
Do you have to call it that?
I don't have to, but I like to.
Well, I'm going to vote yes, even though you did.
Despite that? Okay. Wait till you hear my description of the next one. Senate Bill 373A, this is the invasion of urban of deer into small towns in Eastern Oregon bill.
Yes.
Great. Okay, got that. Okay, back to our informational hearing. Thank you. Welcome.
Welcome. Thank you. Thank you for allowing us to be here today. I know it's towards the end of the session, and you've had a long session. I'm Neil Bryant. I'm an attorney from Bend, Oregon. I've practiced law there for 44 years, and I had the pleasure of being the state senator from that district from 1993 to 2001. And although my principal responsibility was chairing the judiciary, I served on water and land use in 1995. Mm-hmm. And sitting here today in this room is where we met. We did 42 water bills that year. Mm-hmm. And only one got vetoed by Governor Kitzhaber, so that was pretty good negotiation and support. But one of those tried to handle a backlog at water resources. There were 5,000 to 6,000 applications for new groundwater permits in the Deschutes Basin, and none of them were moving or getting approved because the department didn't know what the rules were. The hydraulic connection between surface water and groundwater and the growth in the area. And so we solved that, and Martha Pagel was the executive director of Water Resources at that time, and the bill that went through set some ground rules and allowed those applications to proceed in a normal way with protests and other things. But today I'm here representing Avion Water Company. It's got about 1,200 customer hookups, most of them residential but also commercial, and they do irrigation water. And Deschutes Valley Water District, which is out of Jefferson County, and they supply the water to all the municipalities in Jefferson County. They also operate some other things, and their board are primarily farmers. And why did they get involved in aquifer recharge? Well, in 1998, Martha Pagel called a meeting because we then had the U.S. Geological Survey that said, okay, there is a hydraulic connection. The Deschutes River is over-appropriated. Groundwater, you can't continue to drill wells without mitigation or some balance. And so that led to some mitigation rules. And those were adopted by Water Resources, challenged by Water Watch. The Court of Appeals agreed with Water Watch. Then we came to the legislature and got permission to do rules. And those have been in place since then. But at that time, water users were saying, okay, well, what do we look to in the future? Avion is PUC controlled. And they know that they're going to need additional wells, especially with the growth that's happening in Deschutes County and Bend. City of Bend is going to need additional wells. So will Redmond and Lapine and Sisters. And the logical option was aquifer recharge. It's an unappropriated water that just flows down the river in the winter when you have a good snowfall, and it just goes out to the Columbia. And so the idea is, let's capture that when all the standards are met for fish and wildlife, and then recharge the aquifer. It's challenging to do in Deschutes County because of the aquifer we have. It's not a confined aquifer, but we send it down an irrigation canal, put it into Tumalo's reservoir, which is leaking like a sieve, and then you measure what you take out and what goes in. And then Dave Newton, who sits next to me, is a hydrologist engineer, and we have some monitoring wells from neighbors, and sure enough, their head went up. But most of the water goes down through the basin. And exactly when and where is, you can't scientifically predict that, but you can model it. And the USGA survey is a model. And so we've done this limited application. We've run the test. It seems to work. And we think this is a viable option. Water Resources is stuck, even though it encourages recharge, to make this economically viable, unless the state wants to pay for it like they do in Idaho, which I don't think the state does, you have to have some economic benefit coming back to the people that are spending the money and the time to accomplish this. And for Avion and Deschutes, it's their ratepayers. But their goal is when they want to have then mitigation credits when they drill additional wells. And there'll be some excess mitigation credits, we believe, and so Tumalo Irrigation District would like that too, and we're open for the city of Bend and others. There'll be a permanent mitigation credit for them. They'll have to pay something for it, but that's the idea. The challenge is how to get mitigation credits and what they should be, and then. Dave would have to go through with the modeling. Our clients right now are faced with the dilemma: if they don't want to go forward with more costs and expense, if they don't know that there can be an outcome, and they have to convince their boards about that. And so we hope this discussion leads to a broader discussion, and at some point the legislature would say, all right, let's try this in the Deschutes Basin and figure out a way to get mitigation credits for doing this. And with that, I'll turn it over to Dave, and he can give you some more details on the actual project.
Good morning, Chairman Clem. Representatives. Summer came.
Yeah.
I'm David Newton. I'm registered in Oregon as a civil engineer, a geologist, and a certified water right examiner. I've been involved in water-related issues and projects in the Deschutes Basin for coming on 40 years, which kind of stunned me when I added all that up. And then, you have a handout. I was upstaged by the department with the PowerPoint. Of course, this is reflective of my old age and my old ways. So anyway, bear with me. We'll go through those graphics. But some of this, like Neil pointed out, I mean, Avion Deschutes Valley Water District have to provide for long-term future water supplies. And surface water is not available. They're all going to depend on groundwater over there in the basin, the municipalities, and a lot of other water users in the future. But the hydraulic connection and the potential for measurable reduction in stream flows due to groundwater pumping brought upon this mitigation requirement, which is intended to offset groundwater pumping effects on surface waters. So the way they've been doing that, dry up some land, pull the surface water rights off, transfer them back in stream, boost the stream flow, protect it with an in-stream water right, and then that would offset the groundwater pumping effect. So you kind of have a zero change in consumptive use, balance. But the problem, you have to have water rights on land that you can dry up. So how many of those are there over there? There's a short, uncertain supply, and the projected mitigation demand by 2035 is about 13,000 acre feet of water just to meet mitigation requirements for mostly municipalities. By 2065, it goes up to 20,000 acre feet total. And right now, we know of about 550 acre-feet of water that's available for mitigation purposes. So, there's a hole here and a lot of uncertainty because people, municipalities or others, cannot be certain on when they can get the mitigation water they need to get the new groundwater permit. So it's quite a limbo situation over there right now. So, on that note, back in 2000, Avion and Deschutes Valley Water District and Redmond at the time all applied for this recharge permit. Redmond had a lot of water rights, about 1,000 acres, that they decided, well, we'll convert those, and so pulled out. So right now it's Avion and Deschutes Valley. And the application is for 25,000 acre feet a year. That's the maximum volume at a maximum diversion rate of 200 cubic feet per second. And that water would come out of the Deschutes River and go to this recharge site. That figure one in your packet there is the upper Deschutes Basin. It shows the whole Deschutes Basin, but the shaded area down here toward the bottom is the upper Deschutes Basin, where Ben Redmond and Lapine and Sisters are all located. And that's where our recharge site is. It's shown here, a bit northwest of Ben. The upper basin comprised about 4,400 square miles. A large prolific aquifer there in interlayered basalts and glacial fluvial sediments or volcanic ash and cinders. And the average annual recharge into that basin now is probably around 2.5 million acre feet a year, mostly snowpack, infiltration, very permeable cascade range situation. And but again, the situation is the mitigation challenge again. So figure two, this little map here, shows where we're going to move water from and to in this proposed recharge project. The water will come out of the Deschutes River at Bend, through Tumalo Irrigation District's diversion facilities. And we're doing this, we have a working agreement in place with the district, and that water's conveyed through the Bend Feed Canal and then the Tumalo Feed Canal about 8 miles out to this Tumalo Reservoir. And most of the canal has been piped by the district. Their goal is to pipe their entire district, and ultimately they wouldn't even use the reservoir anymore. So anyway, as the seepage losses in that canal alone range from 1 to 3 cubic feet per second per mile. So if you took an average of 1.5 cubic feet per second a mile over 180-day irrigation seasons, 550 or 600 acre feet just in the canal loss. So it leaks.
And the leakage helps the aquifer.
Yeah.
But by the irrigation district trying to line and pipe the canals, it'll stop that leaking. So right. Then how are you going to recharge the aquifer?
Right.
This would be a logical way to do it.
Yeah. Yeah, the reservoir, the district estimates the reservoir itself just in their use. They don't always fill it, but they'll lose 6,000 acre feet a year just out of the reservoir bottom. And to maintain water, they need to run an inflow of 25 cubic feet per second just to keep the pool. You know, so it just illustrates the permeability out there. And then the site and its outside urban areas, which is another advantage. And in 1914, there was a dam built there in the reservoir, and when they first tried to fill it, they got about 35 feet of water in it, and they lost the whole thing due to a sinkhole developed. So, and flows estimated over 200 cubic feet per second just disappeared, you know. So there's an opportunity here to get water from the surface down into the aquifer system. So. And then, although the primary purpose is mitigation for these two applicants, the other thing that's happening in the basin is canal piping. They've reduced seepage losses by about 60,000 acre feet so far in the basin by piping canals. Groundwater pumping has accelerated. Climate change, we've had relatively dry periods for the last several years. And what we're seeing now in the basin are declines in the groundwater elevations. The mass is around Redmond, down about 12 to 14 feet. And so other benefits we see in this project potentially are helping with some offsets toward those kinds of effects. And the recharge project is the only one over there in the suite of water planning options that responds to this kind of a situation. So there could be other broader range benefits to the project. So, and flooding's another one down in Tumalo area. in the late winter, they've been getting floodwaters down there, and so the recharge project would actually divert water up above them. It would help alleviate those flood risks. So it's just a range of possible benefits. So there's an operation plan we've already put together. It basically is to guide the diversions from the river to be consistent with all the conditions of a water right permit and in a manner that won't infringe on any senior water rights or provisions of the Pelton Settlement Agreement. That was the relicensing of Pelton Round Butte Hydroelectric Project, and there's flow requirements in the river. So we've identified all that, and we've designed this recharge program to account for all those water rights. And then there's a 660 cubic foot per second year-round water right at Bend, and we built in a cushion flow, we call it, of 100 cubic feet per second over the top of that, so we won't divert any water unless we're above 760 cubic feet per second to protect that water right. Oregon Fish and Wildlife evaluated this project, and in terms of impact on maintenance flows in the Deschutes River, rivers at certain flow rates do maintenance, their own maintenance of their channels, okay? And so we wanted to be cautious about any impact there. And they found that the Deschutes River, it's a coarse bed stream. Channel maintenance begins, it flows at about 1,250 cubic feet per second and higher. So when we get up to 1,250 cubic feet per second in the river, we won't divert. We let the river do its thing. So, and then the diversions will be done at a ramping rate, no more than 50 CFS change per hour. We have fish stranding considerations. So we've worked with ODF&W on those kinds of things and the maintenance flows. And then we have an operational agreement with Tunnel Irrigation District under which all this happens. The permit process, this started in 2000. My hair was black, and we're still, but it's been a measured process, patience, and taking it measured steps. The burden, the technical burden, is pretty substantial. We have a lot to do with the Water Resource Department yet, and so we broke it in two phases. The first one was, you know, we're talking about diverting water in the winter out here in Bend, you know, it gets cold. Can we even do this? So the first phase was under a limited license issued by the state that allowed us to do diversion testing. We actually diverted water, ran it through Tunnel Irrigation District facilities into the reservoir, and we were able to determine seepage into the ground. We got about 2,700 acre feet of seepage. And the system worked, the fish screens worked, the district coordination worked, and the coordination with the water master. That's another key piece, that he tells us if water is available or not. And we work closely with him, and we have to account for stock runs. The districts take when they run water in the canals in the winter for their purposes. And so that all proved successful. So now we're at the phase two piece, which is basically subsurface investigation to track the effects of the recharge. And but we didn't want to do anything there until we've gotten some of these other issues taken care of. So we did do, we consulted with the Water Resource Department and about scoping, and the suggestion was look at groundwater elevations in the Tumalo Reservoir area, get a sense of what those are, and then evaluate the possibility of getting water from the ground surface into the aquifer. And so we did that. We put measuring devices in a domestic well about a quarter of a mile east of the reservoir, and it was set to take readings on water elevations. I forget what it was. It seemed like it was every 15 minutes or something like that, so we could catch the little domestic use spikes. And then we measured the well at the Rock Springs Guest Ranch, about 2 miles east of the reservoir. Periodically, we couldn't get an instrument in it. And at the end of the graphics, there's two graphs, these colored graphs, and one for each well. And they essentially show when the irrigation season starts and ends. So, you know, this is leakage from canals out there and ponds and other things. So there's a...
I've got a question about this one.
Oh, yeah.
This little red circle.
Yeah.
What does that represent?
Okay. I skipped that. I missed it. Thank you. Chairman Clem, the circle area, that's where the confluence of the Metolius River, the Deschutes River, and the Crooked River, they all come together by Billy Chinook. And it's there's a large number of springs down there, Chairman Clem. And it's because the canyons down there have cut deeply through a lot of the saturated zones, and then the geology is directing flow that way. So it's like a sink. The groundwater in this system, you can follow the lines with the little arrowheads on them. That's where the majority of the aquifer system actually discharges there into the rivers. The lower 13 miles, the Crooked River gains about 1,100 cubic feet per second. That's groundwater inflow. The Deschutes down there in that north end, about 400 cubic feet per second. And, of course, the Metolius runs about 1,500. So it's all where the groundwater's coming in down there.
So the circle is sort of the beneficial just impact the zone, basically?
Yeah, I just point out where those springs are.
But after that point, I mean, as it goes into that point, our estimation is that's where almost three charges have been accomplished by then.
Yeah. And I put this in, and this is generalized. You know, this is the USGS OWRD map, and those contours you see, it's just like a topographic contours. You know, they show the direction of groundwater flow generally. And then I've got the recharge site on there, and I put this in here simply because our concept, Jen Woody talked about aquifer storage and recovery. You know, you put it in, pump it out. This project, the intent is to leave the water in the aquifer. Kind of like an offset. You know, we're going to put water in the aquifer in exchange for being able to pump some. You know, to maintain a harmony there, so to speak. And then... But I put this in because generally the groundwater, the recharge water, would get into the regional system and then move toward the northeast and then back toward those spring areas and or through the Redmond area where we're getting those declines. So it's how much of that it would resolve, I don't know. But the point is we're just putting water into the system that wasn't there before.
Okay. Any questions over here, my friend? Are you okay for now?
I'm fine, okay. Mr. Chairman.
And I think a few of us want to maybe see if we can get in on this next meeting. So I may wrap this part up now and then see if I can join this next meeting.
Thank you
for coming over and telling us about this. And let me close our informational hearing and close our House Ag and Natural Resources meeting.